This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by Sprout. Sprout is the first ever discount club for pregnancy and parenthood. Born out of the reality of just how expensive having a baby can be, Sprout is here to help you save at what we know to be a truly expensive time. Founded by Sophie, mum to two, Sophie found the adjustment to statutory maternity pay a challenge. And when reflecting on her time as a student, when she had lots of lovely discounts, she found it crazy that as a new parent, there wasn't anything out there for those with little ones. And so Sprout was born. Since launching in 2020, Sprout has now saved its members over £28,000 and now partners with over 90 brands, including Jojo Mum & Baby, My First Years, Mamma Mio Skincare, Natal Active, Bloom & Wild, Latched, Bugaboo and so many more to offer members repeat discounts to help them save. Whether you are pregnant, your partner is pregnant, you're adopting, have little Sprouts or older ones, membership is open to all parents and parents-to-be. Either join for a year or life, and you can now buy a membership for a friend to help them save too. A lifetime membership to Sprout comes with a free gift box. And as a listener of this podcast, by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN, you can save 50% on a lifetime membership and sign up today for only £10. Yes, that is access for life for only £10 by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN. To join the club, simply head to sproutperks.com, choose the lifetime membership and enter the code BUNINTHEOVEN, all lowercase and all one word, and you'll be given instant access to the discounts so you can start saving straight away. Man meets woman, man marries woman, man has sex with woman, woman gets pregnant. This is the story we so often hear about how children are made, but this is just not the reality for everyone. My name's Holly Grant. I'm the founder of The Bump Plan, and you're listening to Bun in the Oven, a podcast that explores the myriad of challenges and routes to becoming and being a parent. For the last 11 years, I've worked across the globe as a Pilates instructor and advanced pre- and postnatal fitness specialist. During that time, I've worked with thousands of people, have heard hundreds of stories about fertility, infertility, pregnancy, and parenthood, and have learned so much about the often rocky road to becoming a parent, which I find fascinating. Bun in the Oven will dive into the many different ways children are brought into this world and what parenting really involves. I hope you find this podcast a huge source of support and that it helps open all our minds. In this first ever episode of Bun in the Oven, I'll be talking about egg donation and the logistics of it, both practically and emotionally. My guest is senior consultant in reproductive medicine, Dr. Meenakshi Chowdhury, and the wonderfully honest Sophie Johnston.
When I was 14, I was diagnosed with ovarian failure, what was called ovarian failure then. I think the term's insufficiency now, that's preferred. My ovaries had stopped working kind of before they'd even started. So I think in a way I'm quite lucky really that I've, obviously that is unlucky, but I'm lucky that I've always known that if I wanted to try and carry a child, I would need to use an egg donor.
I'll be honest, I couldn't believe my luck when Meenakshi agreed to take part in the podcast, as she is an incredible, important woman. Dr. Chowdhury is a leading clinician in reproductive medicine at the internationally renowned Newcastle Fertility Centre at Life and oversees the world-first mitochondrial donor programme. She is passionate about empowering women who volunteer to be donors and give a gift of life to several women who suffer from infertility or deadly inheritable diseases. She is a trustee on the board of national UK charity Sperm Egg Embryo Donation Seed Trust. To read her full bio, head to our show notes, as she really is an incredibly inspiring woman. My other guest is Sophie Johnston, who first reached out to me when I announced I was recording this podcast and offered to share her incredible story of infertility followed by egg donation. I will admit I cried many times during this podcast, and I can't thank her enough for sharing her journey. Sophie works as a dietitian for the NHS with people with neurological conditions and those who have suffered major traumas. And I can confirm, since recording this podcast, she has given birth to a beautiful baby girl, Flo, and says that all her dreams have come true. If you hadn't already guessed it, in this episode, we'll be talking all about egg donation. Donating your eggs to help others become pregnant is one of the most selfless things a woman can do, and it blows my mind at the science that goes on behind the scenes here. You may need some tissues for this episode.
Sophie and Nina. Thank you so much for being on today's podcast.
Hello, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Oh, no, thank you, first of all, Nina, for carving out the time, because when, you know, when I first looked at your bio, you have done a lot and you do a lot and you are an incredibly, incredibly important and incredible woman. So thank you so much for finding the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, as I said earlier.
Gosh, no worries. And Sophie, you are also, well, at the moment, 35 weeks pregnant, but by the time this is out, your little one, I'm sure, will be here. Yes. But Sophie, thank you so much to you as well for finding the time and also for talking about something that I would imagine is going to be a little bit sensitive and a little bit emotive at times. So I really appreciate you coming on here, because I know that you want to help other women as well.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you for covering it, I think.
Gosh, no, I'm interested. I'm so excited about this podcast, because this is just, I guess, a part of fertility and motherhood and pregnancy that I actually just don't know much about. And so I'm really excited personally to learn about it. So I guess, first of all, Sophie, let's start with you. So obviously there's a reason why you're on the podcast here today. And actually you reached out really kindly to me and highlighted this topic. So maybe you could kind of give us a bit of background as to why you're here on the podcast today.
Yeah, sure. So it is a bit of a complicated story with me, so I'll try and keep it brief. But so I was, when I was 14, I was diagnosed with ovarian failure, what was called ovarian failure then. I think the term's insufficiency now, that's preferred. So yeah, my ovaries had stopped working kind of before they'd even started. So I think in a way I'm quite lucky, really, that I've, obviously that is unlucky, but I'm lucky that I've always known that if I wanted to try and carry a child, I would need to use an egg donor. Whereas I think a lot of other women can go through quite a lot to get to that stage. Whereas I've kind of always known, I've known that longer than I haven't known it. I'm 32 now. So sort of fast forward, a good few years, so like 12 years ago when I met my husband, I was always quite open about it with him. And then in 2019, we were referred for fertility services. And yeah, it's a bit, I don't know how much detail you want about the sort of process and things like that. But yeah, I'm now 35 weeks pregnant with the use of an egg donor. We're expecting a little girl. So yeah, we're just really, really grateful that it's all been, it's definitely not been a smooth ride. There's been a lot of bumps in the road, but we're here now and we're just really grateful for that. So I just wanted to, I suppose, raise awareness of it. And I've personally found it really helpful to listen to other people's journeys and experiences, particularly over the past few years. I think it's something that I've always been quite sort of ashamed of. I think a lot of people feel that with fertility issues, it's things that we don't talk about. And I've always sort of grown up and kept it a bit of a secret and not told many people. And it's only been more recently when I've heard other people's experiences and things like that and found that really helpful for me, that it's made me feel like, why am I embarrassed about that? You wouldn't be, you know, if you break your leg, you're not embarrassed about it. It's not my fault that this is what it is. So I thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk about our experience and how we got to where we are.
I'm so grateful that you have, you know, the whole purpose of this podcast is so that nobody is left feeling alone, because you're not alone. And as you said, you know, it's just sometimes a bit difficult to know whether to talk about it. And it is such a huge part of our lives and such an emotive topic. So you found out at 14.
Yeah.
What was the reasoning? Why did you find out?
So I basically just wasn't developing, and my mum, thinking that she was just being a bit of a neurotic mum, took me to the doctors, but turned out she wasn't. So I had scans, blood tests, things like that. And yeah, it turned out that my ovaries were pretty much non-existent by that point. I couldn't really see them on scans. So at the time, we didn't know what had caused it, but I was... when I was 18 or 19, so it took about 5 years, I was diagnosed with lupus, which is an autoimmune condition. So it's thought that that's probably the cause of my ovaries failing. And basically my immune system attacked my ovaries so that they weren't functioning. So that was, yeah, that was how I found out at 14, which is obviously quite young to get that diagnosis. But I think, to be honest, at that point, the main thing I was concerned about is, when am I going to grow some boobs? I wasn't really thinking about fertility at 14. I'm sure I can't really remember it that much, to be honest. I think I've probably processed it a lot more as I've got older, rather than at that time. But it's just meant living on hormone replacement therapy, which I'll come off when I sort of get put through the menopause, I suppose. There's lots of implications of ovarian insufficiency, like in terms of like cardiovascular health and bone health and mental health and things. But the main one, I guess the main focus is fertility, because I don't have any of my own eggs, basically.
So 14 is a really young age, isn't it? To be told, like you said, I guess you almost at that age don't necessarily have the emotional intelligence or the foresight to even consider the fact that it might be that it's going to affect you getting pregnant. We spend so long trying not to get pregnant when we're young and told to be careful. But at that age, you know, I know you've mentioned you don't really remember much of it then. Do you feel like back then you were sort of almost a bit young to really understand what it meant?
Yeah, I think I remember some bits and like lots of appointments and scans and things like that. But the main thing I remember is just being embarrassed, to be honest. I was just like, didn't really want to talk about it. And, I didn't really tell like friends or anything like that. I would just pretend that I was normal and I probably just didn't really process it properly, because I think, like you say, you almost don't really have the skills to think. You don't think as far ahead as a teenager, do you? You think more about the immediate future. I remember being, you know, vaguely upset. I think my mum was probably more affected by it than I was at that age, because I wasn't really thinking about the implications that much. I probably just buried it for a while, I would say.
And I think at that age as well, you desperately don't want to be different to anyone else. You just want to fit in. You do not want to be considered as different to other people. So I can completely see why you might have kept that to yourself.
Yeah.
Mina, is this something that's quite common? Is this quite rare? I mean, it's not something I'd ever been aware of.
Yeah. As Sophie highlighted in her story, that premature ovarian insufficiency is the term used for what previously was described as ovarian failure. It is a rare condition. It's not very common, but it is a condition that we encounter in our clinical practice quite a few times in a year, because we tend to see young girls and women. In my background, I mean, although I'm a fertility expert, I also am the lead for pediatric adolescent young girls with gynecological problems. So I do see a lot of young girls when, say, Sophie was 14 years of age, or even younger than those, who may have problems either not developing boobs or not having periods when they are referred to me, or they may have some genetic condition which results in them not having periods or going through ovarian failure. One of the commonest condition is Turner syndrome. I mean, it's still quite rare, 1 in 1,000 or less than that. But that is a condition where girls are born without the ovaries working at all. And one of the other reasons would be, like Sophie described, is our immune system being attacked by the antibodies that are created, which makes the ovaries not function. And sometimes we don't find any explanation why the ovaries are not functioning, or it functions for some time and then loses its ability to continue growing their eggs. So what I encounter in my clinical practice for young girls, especially much earlier on when I see them, their main focus is fitting in with the peers, as we were discussing. All they want is some development of their bust or breasts. And secondly, they want to have periods, because all their friends are having periods, they're not having periods, they want that. So these are the two main things. Even though parents are more concerned about fertility, when I speak to these young girls, this is their prime objective. These two things are sorted, they don't care about at that point, or they don't want to think about it. And we do encounter that girls may be very quiet in the consultation initially, because these are things which young girls would like to keep to themselves. They don't want to open about it. And here they have to talk about not only get examined, whether the breasts are developing or not, talk about how the periods are happening, not happening, the hormone medications, fertility, future children, and all that, which they're not thinking at that point. So it has to be managed very sensitively. And it's very important that we offer them counseling support, which sometimes is lacking, and open support in the sense that girls can avail it when they want to avail it. So that's what I would say about this condition.
You must have to be so careful with the language that you're using with these young girls as well. And I guess it's the parents also need educating, don't they, on how to talk about it at home. So I'd imagine in the room with you, the children might be so shocked or, like you said, quite quiet. But when they get home, that's when they're going to have all the questions. And as a parent, now I've got a daughter, it must be very difficult to hide your own emotions or sadness for your child. But the language we use is so important, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because you have to try and visualize how a teen would understand and how can you make them talk back to you. Because usually, as we know, I'm a mother of a teenager, so all you will get a hmm and a huh, nothing more than that. Those are the monosyllables they talk in these days. So you have to get to a point where they will open up and talk more freely with you, giving them time to, not in the very first consultation, because you will be bombarding them with diagnosis, the tests, everything and information, but always every visit, giving them little information so they can process that. And next time again, go back to how much they have retained and how we can go on about it. And explaining about the basic biology and physiology of how the hormone works, what importance it has on the womb, on the eggs and the periods and all. Explaining that to them in simple terms helps them to understand and then cope with it a lot better.
Yeah, because to be honest, until I started trying for a child, even though I work with pregnant women, that's more from like a musculoskeletal point of view. But until I started trying for a baby, even I was like, I actually don't really understand the whole cycle situation and that you can only get pregnant at certain times. I felt like it was a massive biological learning when I started to try for a baby. And I was 30-odd. But as a child, yeah, we kind of miss, I think we do miss a lot of that in school as well, don't we? We don't always get the whole biology lesson on periods and things like that. So yeah, it must be so tricky at that young age. So Sophie, you're saying that it was kind of around 18 that then there was a bit more of a clear diagnosis as to why it was happening. Do you know when you sort of understood the ramifications of it from a having a baby point of view?
I think I probably understood the ramifications like pretty much straight away, but I just didn't really, I just kind of put it to the back of my mind and probably didn't process it because it felt like so far away. I think I've probably only fully dealt with it probably in the past 5 years. Like, I'm 32 now. I think probably it's taken me into like my late 20s where I've kind of properly, I suppose, like even grieved, you know, the loss of my genetics with any child that we potentially have. I think it's taken me a long time to process that. I think partly because of the sort of shame and embarrassment, you almost don't let yourself think about it too much because it's easier not to. You don't need to think about that now. It's not something that you're interested in at the moment. And I think I was almost quite, well, I don't want children anyway, it's fine, you know, where I did, but it was almost like a self-protection thing to not be very maternal and not be that interested in children. Whereas as I've got older, I think, and I suppose more mature, I've been able to deal with it. And that's when I found kind of reading and listening to other people's stories and things really, really helpful.
That's why it's so important that we talk, because like you said, yeah, if it's easy to just forget about it, no one else is talking about it, you can just kind of stay in the zone. Yeah. But it's not really dealing with the issue, is there?
Definitely. And I think talking to people about it as well and being more open is definitely, obviously everybody's different and some people maybe would never want to tell anybody, which is absolutely fine. But for me, I've definitely felt it's really helped me process it. And I think the same with my husband as well, that he's found being more open about it has helped us accept it more, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So growing up then, when you had relationships that were getting more serious, was there sort of this point where you would think, oh, I should probably tell them? Or was it something you told them straight away? Or how did you deal with that?
Yeah, I think I've only had like one serious boyfriend before, my now husband, but with him as well, and with Nick, my husband, I was pretty open from quite early on. So I think you almost have, you almost feel a bit guilty if I wasn't open about it, because I suppose that's another part of the shame as well, that you worry that you'll be rejected. So you'd rather just do that straight away. So if they're going to say, no, I'm not interested in you, it's easier to do it now rather than wait kind of down the line, because it is something that's going to affect them as well. I can't remember how soon I told Nick. Probably too soon. He was probably like, why are you even telling me this now? So we met when we were 20. So I think for him, he wasn't that not that he wasn't bothered, but I think similar to how I acted when I was younger about it, he was, well, not ready for children. Why are we even talking about this now? You know? So yeah, but I was open about it from quite early on with him. Yeah.
Do you remember feeling that was quite a tough conversation to have? Or 'cause I can only imagine that it must be a really difficult thing to tell somebody, but
yeah,
you've lived with it for a long time. Does it feel kind of just normal?
Honestly, I think I probably had a bit to drink when I told him. I think I had a little bit of Dutch courage. I don't remember specifically when I told him. I'd have to ask him, actually. I should have asked him before this. When did I tell you this? But yeah, I do have kind of vague memories of sort of panicking and thinking and just feeling like I had to tell him, feeling pressure, like I need to tell him this soon. Just so he's got the chance to sort of bow out. That sounds horrible, but that's almost how you think about it. Like, I don't want to take something away from somebody else. Because as well as knowing that I would need to use a donor, I didn't know if it would ever work. So I don't think I had much of a build up to it, because I think I probably just had a bit of Dutch courage and just did it. Yeah, yeah. But like I said, because he wasn't thinking about children anytime soon or anything like that, it was actually fine. Other people, you know, maybe if they have that conversation later down the line, it might be a different situation, but it was never really. And he is, like, my husband is probably the most chilled. We're very different. I'm not very chilled. He is the most chilled person in the world. So yeah, it just was never really, it's just never really been a problem, luckily.
Yeah. And when did you guys then start discussing the thought of having children together and what your options were?
I don't know when we first started discussing it, really. I think I was probably ready to talk about it before him, because I'm a bit of a planner, and I knew it might take a while. It was going to be quite complicated. Whereas, as I said, he is pretty chilled. So he probably wasn't thinking about it as early on as me. Probably it's probably sort of mid to late 20s, and we both knew that we wanted to try and have a family. So that kind of wasn't really a question. We both sort of agreed quite early on that we knew we would want to pursue IVF with egg donation. It was more just sort of when. And we got married in 2019, so we were referred earlier in the year, because we knew it might take a while as well, and it was on the NHS, so waiting times and things like that. So it was probably about maybe 8 months before we got married. We were initially referred. We knew what it would involve, and we knew we would definitely wanted to try it. So it wasn't really that much of there wasn't really that much to sort of consider for us there, because we just both knew that was what we wanted to do.
So Mina, then, what are the different reasons that somebody might then go down the egg donation route? And also, what are the different options that would have been available to Sophie?
Right. So there are several reasons that women may need donor eggs. One of the most common reason is that we encounter in our day-to-day practice is someone having had gone through cancer treatment or had chemotherapy. So because of that, their ovaries switch off. And so it's much later on they had ovaries which were functioning fine, and then subsequently when they had to go through, say, breast cancer diagnosis or had chemotherapy after that, and their ovaries stopped working, those might be a group of women who may need donor eggs for their own treatment. The other group of women would be who had any genetic condition or any autoimmune condition that their ovaries stopped working. Say Sophie would be one of those women who needed donor eggs. And for those who know it from right from beginning, although initially they don't comprehend what magnanimous outcome it may have on their life at an earlier age, but later on they come to terms with it and then they understand the various options. One of the most rising trend we have seen for donor egg use these days are women who are older, because as we know, the age of having children or planning for a pregnancy is increasing day by day. The first age of first child in UK has increased tremendously over the years. And because of that, when women are older, the chance of them falling pregnant and having a baby, healthy baby with their own eggs, starts to decline dramatically. And for that reason, women in the late 40s may consider using donor eggs. So that's one of the commonest reasons. Other options that would have been open for Sophie would be, or women in similar position, would be either to consider adoption, fostering, or having a child-free life. So those will be the other options. But egg donation is quite common nowadays. Every year in the UK, more than 4,000 egg donor cycles are done.
That's amazing, isn't it? And so, Sophie, was it kind of quite clear for you guys that you knew that this was the route you were going to go down and you were going to give this a good go?
Yeah, definitely. I think, luckily, we both felt exactly the same, that this was the way that we... And it's definitely not to say that we would have completely ruled out kind of adoption and things like that. I think it's an amazing thing to do. But for us, we just... really wanted to try this way, but kind of going into it knowing we don't know if this will work, but we wanted to give it a good shot. Yeah.
So Mina, how does it work? It's just incredible, and I did not realize it was that common, so 4,000 a year. So talk us through where does it even begin? Fantastic.
So if we look at it, IVF is a very common treatment in the UK. One in six couples may have some kind of fertility issues and they may need to go down the IVF route. So every year, around 60,000 cycles of IVF happens in the UK, of which I would say, as I mentioned earlier, that around 4,000 would be with donor egg treatment. That is just over 6% of the cycles are related to donor eggs. What happens is that women who need donor egg treatment would need to be aligned for the treatment with someone else who is willing to donate the egg. So there would be healthy volunteers, women who are altruistically keen on helping someone else have a baby, and they would come forward to give what I class as the gift of life. So they want to help somebody else and give a gift of life by giving them a chance at having a baby. So if a woman expresses an interest to donate her eggs, they will have to go through a stringent process of screening, what we call as, because we will be taking their whole medical history into account, her family history, are there any genetic conditions that can be passed on, because we don't want to put that risk on the woman who will be considering using those donor eggs. So we will be asking their whole family, personal, medical history. We will be doing a range of tests on them, and that would include infection screening, blood tests, ultrasound scan to see if they've got good enough egg reserve to go through the process, genetic testing to make sure that we're not having any risk of any genetic condition, including cystic fibrosis, that can be passed on and result in an inheritable condition in any resultant baby. And subsequently, they have to be committed for the process, because the process is not a short process. They will have to have implications counseling, including how they feel about a child being created, where they will have no contact with the child initially, as well as what they feel about the donor anonymity laws of the UK. So if we look at it, the law in the UK says that if someone is going through, someone who is keen on donating their eggs, any resultant child, so for instance, when Sophie's daughter is born, at the age of 18 years, she can find out who was the biological person who donated. So that's important for the donor to consider that, because sometimes the donor might have not yet had her own family. So how would she feel about having someone else who would share the genetic makeup of hers and with her daughter or son, with her child? So we have to take all that into account. Similarly, for someone who needs the donor eggs, like Sophie, they will have to go through a screening process as well, so we can match her up with the donor, not only the physical characteristics, also sometimes women and couples would like to match with the, say, blood group, so that they would have similar blood group as theirs. They may want to match them with the physical characteristics of hair and all that. And also ethnicity. Sometimes, I mean, we don't tell them that, okay, if you're white, you have to go for a white donor. If you're black, you have to go for a black donor or Asian donor. But we do tell them, these are the available options for the donors. What would you like to go for? And ethnic matching, if a person themselves wants to consider that, so that when raising the child, they would feel they belong to that culture, to the community, in the society, that's absolutely fine. It is acceptable, it's fine, and it would make the child feel a part of the family. So that is allowed and fine. And once we have looked at all the screening tests for both of them and have matched the donor with the recipient, then what would happen is, one can do cycles simultaneously. What it means is that, say, for instance, we can use fresh eggs or frozen eggs. If we are using fresh eggs, then what would happen is a person like Sophie will be starting on her medications, and I'll talk about the hormones she may need to take, so that she is ready to receive the embryo in her womb at the same time when we have collected the embryo eggs from the donor who was going through. So the donor will have to go through hormone injections so we can stimulate her ovaries so she can have a lot of eggs collected. That may take roughly around 10 to 12 days of injections. This is a rough guide, around a couple of weeks of injections. And we monitor them by ultrasound scan to see how they are growing. Once those eggs have grown to a certain size, or the follicles, which are the fluid-filled bubbles which contains the eggs inside them. So once we have collected that, then once they have grown to a right size, then we would align them to go for an egg collection procedure. Now that procedure is like an outpatient procedure where women come in, and it can be done under sedation, and it's an internal ultrasound scan where we pass a needle into both her ovaries and take the fluid out from the follicles. And then they're looked under the microscope to see how many eggs we have collected from the woman. If the eggs, when they're collected, if they're fine, then the partner of the woman who needs to receive the eggs, if she has a partner or sperm donor, if she's a single woman, will be used to mix the eggs with the sperm of that person, and embryos will be created. It usually takes up to 5 days of culturing those embryos in a dish in the laboratory before they're ready to be implanted or transferred, and we aim to put back one embryo. Now, the person who is receiving the egg, that woman, a person, would be going through estrogen tablets. So say, for example, if Sophie's doesn't produce any hormones herself naturally because her ovaries are not working, so she will be given some estrogen, some form of hormone therapy, like estrogen, in the gel form, in the patches form, or the tablet form, to take for a few days till the donor was ready for her egg collection. The day the donor eggs are collected, same day Sophie will be starting on another hormone, that is the progesterone. So in our natural cycle, those who get periods normally, they would have first the estrogen hormone rising, and once the egg is released, the second hormone kicks in, the progesterone, which helps for a pregnancy to implant if it is going to happen. So then in that case, the person will be both on the estrogen and the progesterone hormone. And then 5 days later or so, once the embryo reaches a stage, what we call as a blastocyst stage, which are a ball of cells of around 100 to 150 cells, then we will be putting that inside, replacing that embryo inside the womb of the cavity of the womb of the person. And then usually a few days later, around 8 to 10 days later, we'll be doing a pregnancy test to see if it has implanted or attached. In the UK, the law says that we should not transfer more than 2 embryos for someone who is young, like Sophie, but maximum is 3, one cannot. But the aim is to reduce the risk of any complications of pregnancy that can happen with multiple pregnancy. So we aim to put back 1 embryo. And I don't know, Sophie will be able to tell us whether she had 1 embryo put back or not, but usually we aim to put back 1 embryo in that case.
This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by The Bump Plan. Given the theme of this podcast, I imagine that some of you are currently pregnant or planning a family. So many women I know just aren't sure how to move their body safely during this changing time. Or they want to stay active but need someone to show them the way and hold their hand. That's where The Bump Plan comes in. The Bump Plan is a holistic prenatal fitness plan that allows you to work out with confidence at each trimester of your pregnancy. Founded by myself, Holly Grant, the Bump Plan has already helped over 10,000 pregnant women stay active safely and feel empowered throughout their pregnancies. Through its trimester-specific workouts, in which I'm always at the same stage of my pregnancy as you will be in yours, hypnobirthing subscription and extensive education hub, you'll feel supported and part of a welcome community. Let me help you move safely through your pregnancy, maintain your fitness and strength, and enter parenthood strong and prepared for all the demands it poses. As a listener of Bun in the Oven, I'm offering you £5 per month off the cost of your monthly subscription to The Bump Plan, simply by entering the code BUN at checkout. To get started today, simply head to pilatespt.co.uk/the-bump-plan and enter the code BUN at checkout. That's B-U-N in lowercase to get £5 off the monthly cost of The Bump Plan. Join our community today and stay strong throughout your pregnancy.
I feel so emotional. It's just unbelievable that there is a woman out there who is willing to give an egg, knowing the implications potentially 18 years later, but also as a mum as well, knowing that somebody is giving you that gift, and also that that is something that you would not have been able to have had you not gone through all of that. So I can imagine, Sophie, that it's such a long journey and filled with, you know, worry and concern, but also just how incredible that this is even an option. I feel quite emotional. Sophie, talk us through what it was like then, because obviously Mina's talking us through, like, you know, that side of things and how it all works. Do you remember each stage, or has it kind of become a bit of a blur?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit more complicated with me because I, so my womb, when they did the initial investigations and things, my womb was very underdeveloped and I had a very thin lining, potentially hadn't been on high enough hormones prior to that. So we were kind of told initially, actually, this might not work, but you need to have high dose hormones at first to sort of improve the lining of your womb and things. And then I've also got some blood clotting issues, so having high dose hormones increases the risk there. So there's kind of lots of hematologists involved and things as well, so it was a little bit more complicated. And then COVID happened just as I was about to start everything, so that put obviously a spanner in the works and everything was delayed. And also where we were referred on the NHS, they don't have an egg donor bank, unfortunately. So we were told we'd have to go private and then attempt to apply the NHS funding for that. So depending on where you live, you may or may not be entitled to NHS funding. I think the NICE guidelines say people should get three shots at it, but it's a postcode lottery. We would have been entitled to one where we live. But then everything kind of shut down mid-COVID, and we were recommended a clinic by a friend of a friend that they used, and we actually made the decision to then go abroad. So it'll be slightly different for us in terms of the implications because it's completely anonymous, and when she's 18, unfortunately, she won't have the option of contacting the donor. So that's something we've kind of extra that we've had to process. But yeah, so I was basically put on the high dose hormones, like regular checks of my womb, and thankfully it did work. And then we had to start the planning of traveling abroad mid global pandemic, which honestly was probably one of the more stressful aspects of it, because flights kept getting cancelled. And it was the November that we went, so it was when there was kind of complete travel ban, other than for medical reasons. So that was pretty stressful. And in terms of the hormones, it was quite difficult. I think more than anything, emotionally, I found it really, really hard. The higher doses that I was having to kind of build up my womb, I was just an absolute wreck. Like, I was talking to my husband about this the other day, that I just was so emotional. Anything could make me cry. He once bought phyllo pastry instead of puff pastry. And honestly, you would have thought it was the end of the world. Like, I cried for about 15 minutes solidly about pastry. It was just, I can't even explain it. I was an absolute emotional wreck. So I found that really, really tough, a lot tougher than I thought I would. And I think also people not knowing as well. So I felt like I really wasn't myself at all. And a few people, like very close friends and family, did know, but we at that stage, because we didn't know if anything would work, we didn't really want the pressure of people knowing. You know, people don't tend to tell people when they're trying for a baby naturally. So even more so for us, when there were sort of more risks and things involved, we didn't want to sort of tell the world. So I found that quite hard as well. And obviously mid-COVID, the social isolation as well. So I was in the vulnerable category because of lupus, so not really seeing people. So yeah, I think I went pretty nuts during that period. But eventually, after lots of cancelled flights and things like that, yeah, we got out there. And to be honest, the actual transfer was probably the simplest thing throughout the entire process. I've had worse smear tests. It was absolutely fine. It was pretty amazing, really. Like, you watch on the screen, you see your embryo, you've had updates throughout, you know, those 5 days of how many you've got, how many have fertilized, how many have survived, what grade they are. So you're kind of on edge all the time. And then you see the embryo on the screen. And I did just have one, transferred, because, like you say, because of the risks and things. I think particularly abroad, maybe they're not as strict on that, and I think some places do put more in, but they felt, because I was higher risk as well, because of blood clotting issues and lupus and things like that, that it wasn't a good idea. Yeah, you then watch on screen as you see like a little flash of light as the fluid goes in, and it's mad. It's like that's your embryo and potentially your child that you've just seen go in. It's pretty amazing. Nick wasn't allowed to go in for that bit because of COVID. There were kind of more restrictions. But yeah, it was pretty amazing. And then in terms of medications and things, that's quite intense. It's quite a lot to remember. Had lots of alarms set because I was terrified that I would forget something or take something at the wrong time. So I had like estrogen patches because it lowers the blood clotting risk rather than having it orally. And the progesterone injections and pessaries as well. So you put them in like vaginally at certain times of the day, and then blood thinners as well. So I had oral ones and injections. So Nick has become very good at delivering injections. He even says sharp scratch before he does it still now. It's quite intense, I would say. It's a lot to remember and it feels like a lot of pressure. And then I think probably the worst bit is that 2 week wait to do the test, to know if it's worked. And you're constantly asking yourself, do I feel a bit sick because I'm on lots of progesterone, or is it because I'm pregnant? And do I feel really emotional because I'm pumping myself full of hormones, or is it because I'm pregnant? You kind of question and Google everything. It was probably just an extra stress because of COVID. We had to quarantine out there before we went we had to quarantine at a government selected hotel when we got there, and then again quarantine when we got home. So there was kind of lots of extra bits thrown in for us, but it probably was the most stressful time of our lives, I would say. But also, when you think about everything that's happening, it's pretty amazing as well. And yeah, you take the medications and things for 12 weeks, and then I like weaned off them. And I think to me that was one of the most amazing things, like as someone who has taken hormones constantly since I was 14, it blows my mind that I now have a placenta that makes everything for her. It's just mad. It was quite scary really coming off the drugs and trusting that my body was doing what it needed to do for her, but also quite nice to not be on a concoction of so many drugs. I do still wake up in the night in sweating, panicking that I've not taken something that I should, even though it's been 20 something weeks since I've had to take them. I still have that panic. I quite often wake up and think, oh, I've forgotten to have this injection, and I haven't. It's just kind of still in there. You just want to do everything you can to make it work, really.
Gosh, Sophie, that is just so much to go through and deal with. And I just, I don't even know what to say. There's no words. When I think of how smooth, you know, my pregnancy was, and even I was like, oh God, I feel crap. And to just think of the levels that you've gone to and the different obstacles you've gone through, and to know that you're now 35 weeks, you're not having to take medication. It's just, it's magic. And Mina, oh my gosh, that you get to work in that field. It is actually just magic, isn't it? Well, it's science, so it's not magic.
The most important thing is that sometimes women ask us, will I be able to breastfeed my baby? Because they think they've always been on hormones and all. But yes, they would be naturally be able to breastfeed. The breast milk also comes naturally. So it is indeed quite a surprise how someone in the past, when technology hadn't advanced, had no chance of having a possibility of carrying a child or giving birth to a baby if their ovaries were not working. Thanks to the advancement in the technology, now they can have a pregnancy, have a baby, breastfeed the baby as well, and have further babies as well if they wanted to extend the family.
I did not know. So you'll be able to breastfeed because of medication, or just because your body knows that you've given birth?
Because the body knows you have given birth. So because the breast milk is secreted by a signaling pathway in the brain, and Sophie's should be working absolutely fine. So majority of these young women who would be having babies through donor egg treatment or through surrogacy arrangement or whatever type of other treatment options will be able to breastfeed their baby if they wanted to.
That is just incredible. That is just, oh my gosh.
I don't think anyone has ever been as excited as I was to start leaking colostrum at 16 weeks. I was like, oh, this might really work.
That's incredible. Wow. Yeah. That's eye-opening.
Polly, I just wanted to allude to what Sophie was saying. Sophie, I'm so sorry that because of not having the availability on the NHS for your treatment cycle, you had to seek donor egg treatment abroad. And that is a thing which I hope that during our lifetime that would change, because there is indeed still an existing postcode lottery, the NICE, which is the national governing guidance body of National Institute of Clinical Excellence. They published a guidance which states that a woman should be offered 3 cycles on the NHS and has got criteria for that. We are fortunate up in Newcastle, we do offer 3 cycles to women based on the eligibility criteria. So majority of them do get 3 cycles. And also we do have our in-house donor egg bank, but women who can come forth to donate. So I'm very thankful to the women of the Northeast who come forward to donate. But I think this is something which should change, and we should have a collective voice so that everyone, no matter where you live in the country, have got the same right of access to fertility treatment on the NHS as someone else.
And Mina, is it a case of not having enough egg donors? Do we need more egg donors, or is it kind of just the cost implications or a combination of the two?
Yeah, I mean, the postcode lottery is not only for egg donors, but it's for all sorts of treatment, IVF treatment, even if you're using your own eggs. So some places will have no funding. Others would offer only one cycle and some three cycles. But there has been a huge shortage of egg donors across the UK, and that has driven women to seek donor egg treatment abroad because of the long waiting time. We used to have a waiting list of around 3 to 5 years when I first started here in Newcastle. And now it's come down to 18 months to 2 years, but that is still not acceptable because it's still long. So there is a waiting list, and especially if you belong to an ethnic minority, more than half of the women who need donor egg treatment have to go for a white donor, because if they waited for an ethnic match donor, they would never get that. So there is a waiting list for donor egg treatment across. Other options would be that someone known to you may be willing to donate their egg. So that is known as known egg donation. So this, these are family friends. If they are less than 35 years or younger, they can consider helping out. And we have had few cases where women did come forward to help their friends and family. The other group of women in the UK are those who need fertility treatment themselves, but they're not eligible to have the treatment on the NHS. So as a benefit in kind, they opt to share half of their eggs with someone else who needs them. So that is known as egg sharing. So that is a third way of helping someone else with the giving the donated eggs. I mean, in Newcastle, we are the only centre in the UK where we have three options for women who volunteer to donate eggs. So one is to women similar to Sophie, where they need the whole eggs for their treatment to have a baby, a genetically linked child. Other is to donate eggs for research purposes. So we do have a lot of women who come forward to donate eggs for research purposes. So they're solely used to study why women's eggs age at certain point, why genetically some women's ovary stops working, a lot of reasons that we study on the eggs. So that's the second group. And the third group is that Newcastle has the world's first license for mitochondrial donation. Now, I don't know whether you know about it or not, but it is donating your eggs to help a woman or a couple where the woman suffers from an inheritable condition, which is known as a mitochondrial DNA disease. And because she will pass it on to her children, it's a life-threatening condition. She may lose some kids, child, because they're affected with this condition. They can have a genetically linked child to themselves, but using healthy mitochondria from the donor. So simplest way to describe that is, if we look at an egg, there's egg white and egg yolk. So egg yolk is our nuclear DNA, which gives us all our characteristics and all our gene pool. And the egg white is where the mitochondria are present, or which are like the power cells of helping our body function, the various organs. So it could be the heart, lungs, and all. So if you look at a camera, when you put the battery in it, the camera would function. If you don't put the battery, if the batteries are faulty or old batteries, the camera wouldn't function. So that's the role of the mitochondria. But the features, how good the picture quality will be, will it be color, the resolution and all, will depend on the inherent features of that camera. So that is from the nuclear DNA or the egg yolk. So what happens is the nuclear DNA is switched over, the egg yolk is switched over. So the healthy mitochondria is taken from the donor, replaced with the nuclear DNA from this woman who suffers from this deadly condition, and replaced with that, with her husband's sperm, so that the nuclear DNA belongs to the mom, but the healthy mitochondria belongs to the donor. So that's the third type of treatment, which is also known as three-person baby. So we have got these three options for women who wish to consider donating eggs.
Wow, that's incredible. I didn't know that was available, and that's absolutely incredible. Do you notice, Mina, a kind of trend in the women that do donate eggs? Does it tend to be women who've already had their families who think, I'm not having any more children myself, so I'll donate? Is it people who've chosen to not have their own children? Are there any trends, or does it seem to be just a real mix of women who just want to help other people?
I would say that there we see women from all walks of life coming forward to donate eggs. The most important, what I feel personally, is that the reason why women don't come, why there is a shortage of donors in the UK, is the awareness about it. Because as Sophie said, fertility problems is a big stigma and people don't want to talk about it. They don't spread about what is required. So a lot of women who come forward, they say, oh, we never knew that donor egg, one could donate eggs to help someone else. So they are quite often open. One of the causes people thought in the past that maybe it's the financial motivation. So abroad and all, where there is no shortage of donors, some of the countries can compensate women who donate to a huge amount of financial help. But in the UK, it is heavily regulated by the governing body, that is the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, or commonly referred to as HFEA. So a person who donates their eggs, they can only be offered a compensation of up to £750. So initially it was thought that, and this was allowed from 2012 onwards, so that's when the policy came in about offering financial compensation. So people thought that probably it is the financial motivation, so we may see a lot of younger university students or someone donating. However, when we have looked at our data and our experience, women in a high position of work career ladder also has donated, women who do not have any children has donated, and women who have kids have donated. And sometimes they have been because, quite often it is because they have had a friend or a family who's gone through fertility problems, or they've heard about it, and that's when they come to inquire about it, and they wanted to help out and donate. So it's really for altruistic reasons, and financial compensation does not play a huge part, which was a myth, I would say. So there, yes, there are people from all walks of life who come forward to donate.
So I guess it's a lack of awareness that's probably
indeed.
That. And to be honest, it was only when I was kind of researching into this that I started thinking, like, you know, is it something I would consider? And I think if I was speaking completely openly, personally, I think the thought that, like you've mentioned, that when that, if that egg is then used to create a child, when that child reaches the age of 18, they can contact you if they wish, but you personally are allowed no information about that child. I think for me, I'd be thinking 18 years later, you know, I wonder if, or that feeling of constantly thinking, oh, I wonder what they're up to. I wonder if that might put some women off. Was that something, Sophie, for you that you guys did have to think about? I know you've said that abroad that doesn't apply, but I guess when you first thought about doing this, you knew that was a very real option, that at 18 they could contact the
agency. Yeah, I think for us, like, I actually feel quite guilty that she won't have that option. I think everybody has sort of different views and opinions on that, but I've read quite a lot of things written by donor conceived adults, and I think generally the consent, and there's quite a lot of research on it now, and generally the consensus is to have open donation is better. I mean, I know it's called anonymous, but they have that option then when they're an adult, and even if they make the decision that they don't want to make contact, at least that's their decision, whereas I almost feel like we were sort of not really left with a choice and we had to take that away. Obviously there's more options and things out there, and I'm sure there will be in 18 years with, you know, like DNA testing and things like that. I know a lot of donor conceived adults have contacted genetic siblings and donors and things that way. But I think it's just something that we've always got to be aware of, that as she grows up, you know, our plan is to always be completely open about it, and just be aware that might be something that comes up, and that we just have to be honest that you know, this is the situation, and hope that she's okay with it either way. But yeah, it's definitely something we thought about and considered and talked about quite a lot. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why anyone that has, as you mentioned, Mina, has to have like the implications counselling, so that you've processed and thought about this, and you've sort of preempted things that might come up, because it's so important. It's not just about getting pregnant, it's so much bigger than that. You know, you're creating a human who's going to have their own kind of wishes and desires, and you don't know how they will react to be to being donor conceived. So it's just important, I guess, to be aware of and think about it so that you know that these things might come up.
The thing that keeps coming back to me as well is that I can't work it out if it is essentially the equivalent of a sperm donor, because it feels so much different to that. But is it the equivalent? Is it as simple as that? Or is it that it's a much bigger, you know, there's the hormones that have to come. It's very different from giving a semen donation. Is it the same or is it very different?
Yeah, the law is the same regarding the donor anonymity rules and all that for sperm donor and egg donation. However, the process involved, although the initial screening tests and all are quite similar, like genetic screening and medical history and all that. However, the process of donation is, I would say, a lot simpler for a man who is willing to donate their sperm compared to a woman. A man, when he's donating, he just has to produce a sample. He doesn't need to go through any hormone injections and all the emotional sides that goes with the taking the hormone injections, as Sophie was mentioning. When she was taking the hormone therapy, that time she was experiencing all these moods going up and down. Similarly, a donor may go through, but men do not have to go through because they're producing a sample. And for sperm donors, they produce a sample in advance and they can be frozen and then defrosted and used whenever it is required to be used, and can be used just in a natural cycle for a woman, because you just inseminate the semen or the sperm, washed sperm, into the womb rather than going through a whole different process which the donor has to go through. So usually, currently, most of the centers in the UK still go for fresh egg donation when they're using a donor egg. But donor egg banks are becoming popular and is emerging as well. The success rate of surviving defrosting of a frozen egg is less compared to when you're using a fresh egg. So that's why it's not the most preferred option yet, but it will open up a lot of opportunities for if, say, the woman who's receiving the donor egg is not ready at the same time, the donor eggs could be frozen for later use, or completely disjoint the two processes so they can have more match later on if they wanted to select.
Gosh, yeah, that does make sense. It's a much bigger, it's just a much bigger journey, isn't it, if you're going to be an egg donor than essentially.
Indeed it is. I don't know whether you're aware or not, there has been increasing options for same-sex couples coming through fertility treatment where they both wanted to be the part of the journey together. So one partner would donate her eggs to the other partner, so the other partner carries the pregnancy, but genetically it's linked to the one partner. So in the past, it was classed as donor egg treatment, like donating eggs to your partner. However, recently, just in June of this year, HFEA changed the regulations and the guidance regarding that. So they're not classed as a donor. They're just providing the eggs for their partner's treatment. So that is one big change that has been made. But yeah, it gives them also an opportunity of both to feel part of the journey and the process.
Yeah. And so, Sophie, I know that we've talked outside of this about kind of pregnancy and how it can be really, really tough. Have you felt pressure to be even more ecstatic given the journey that you've been on?
Absolutely, which has been made a lot more difficult by the fact that I've struggled with hyperemesis quite badly. I mean, only a few weeks ago, I was admitted to hospital for like IV fluids and IV medication. So still, I'm definitely better than I was, but I'm on a lot of anti-sickness medication to kind of keep me going. And I still have some terrible days, even this late into it, which, yeah, I really, really, really struggled with. I think I've come to terms with it a bit more now, and I will openly say I have found pregnancy really difficult and I haven't enjoyed it. And whereas at first I think I felt so guilty saying that and feeling it, because this is something that I have always wanted and never really let myself believe that it would happen. And still sometimes now I don't believe that it's real. And so for me to say I'm not enjoying it is difficult, and I feel guilty, and I know that there's so many women out there that would kill to be in my position, but that doesn't make it any easier. And I think it's another kind of stigma, and another, I guess it's just mum guilt, isn't it, that you have already. She's not even here yet, and I already feel guilty for saying out loud, pregnancy is pretty rubbish for some people. And I'm definitely one of them. It's been really difficult. And I think not even just with the sickness, but just mentally, and the anxiety that I've felt and still feel now is just constant. So every, you know, even that first, after the 2-week wait, the positive pregnancy test, it's not how I imagine a lot of people when they have a positive pregnancy test are just absolutely buzzing and feeling really positive. It definitely wasn't like that for us, because we just constantly felt like this is going to get taken away at any point, and at every scan and at every, you know, appointment, it's, is this going to end now? Is that it? So that's just kind of been hanging over us the whole time. So yeah, it doesn't feel like, I suppose there's probably a bit of a misconception that if you have IVF or you have some kind of fertility treatment, that as soon as you get pregnant, that everything's all kind of sunshine and rainbows. And it definitely in our case hasn't been that way. It's been really, really tough. It's been really difficult. And I think, yeah, there's still a part of me that doesn't really let myself believe that everything will be okay, even though we're so close now. It gets better, definitely. But, you know, even things like buying the pram or getting the nursery ready, it's taken me quite a long time to allow myself to prepare things and get things ready, and to tell people as well. We waited quite a while. I mean, COVID made that a bit easier because no one could see me vomiting or me growing size wise but I think, and I would imagine it's similar from other people I've spoken to, that they you know, have similar feelings, that if it's taken quite a lot for them to get to this place, or they've known for a long time that they may never, there's a lot of anxiety associated with it, definitely, that makes it more difficult to enjoy, which you then feel guilty about.
Actually, listening to the journey that you've been on, it's almost no surprise that, of course, this pregnancy would be really hard work because of the reasons you've listed, you know, not wanting to get excited, not being able to necessarily like just relax, because there's always that concern. After hearing that, I would be surprised if you did say, oh, I've absolutely loved pregnancy, it's fantastic. And it does not have any reflection on your love for your daughter. It is just simply that your body has been through so much to get to this point. And I guess there will, the only advice that I can give as well, given knowing what's to come, is that I would imagine there'll also be days when they're here where you're like, oh my gosh, they're such a nightmare. And then you feel guilty afterwards because you feel like you should be really grateful that they're here, but it does not mean that you don't love them. It's just that it is it's hard work. And you've been through so much. So, but thank you for being so honest, because if people don't say pregnancy's been really tough, then we all go into it thinking that it is going to be sunshine and roses.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about when she's here?
Part of me can't really imagine it. We're just so, so excited. And we know, as you say, there's going to be days where we're like, this is so hard. We know it's not going to be easy. I just can't put in words how excited we are and how amazed we are and just grateful. I just feel so grateful. And as much as I'm saying I've not enjoyed pregnancy, I am still amazed. I'm amazed by my body every day that this has happened, and that I have a bump. It just still blows my mind that we are where we are. But I think in terms of the fact that we've used a donor, how do we feel? Honestly, we don't really think about it very often. It's such a small part. It feels like such a small part now of our journey and of who she is. It's definitely not something that we would kind of neglect to talk to her about. And we've prepared and bought, books and things like that to help, obviously, when she's a little bit older, explain. But to us, it's just an amazing part of who she will be, rather than, neither of us really have any sort of worries or or hesitations about the fact that we've used a donor. I'm sure things will come up, and I'm sure there'll be challenges and difficult conversations. I've got no doubt about that, but it's just part of a massive journey. I think it's just one small part of it, really.
And she's yours.
Exactly. Yeah. There's not any. There's no part of us that has ever sort of questioned that or worried about it at all. I think I'm sure when she's here, there'll be, you know, people when they see children, they like to say, "Oh, who do they look like?" Or do you, you know? I'm sure things like that will come up. It's not something we really think about that often. It's just she's ours and she's okay at the moment, and hopefully she will be here soon. And yeah, that's kind of it, really.
Oh, Mina, if there's anyone listening who is considering donating their eggs or considering using an egg donor, is there anything that you would like to say to them before we finish? Is there anything that we might have missed?
No, I think the most important message to anyone considering donating eggs, I would say thank you so much for even considering or expressing an interest, because you're giving a huge gift of life to someone else. You're creating families, and that's the biggest joy you can give to someone else. So thanks a lot for even considering that. And secondly, I would say that if you are considering, or if you don't know what it involves, please feel free to visit the HFEA website, which may give information about centers locally to where you live, where you can get more information about donation. If you are living in the Northeast, please contact us on the Newcastle website. And those who are considering using donated eggs, it will be a journey which will be different from many other women. But when we see women in the clinic, when we ask them, "What do you want?" All of them just say one thing: we want a baby. They never say we want a genetically linked baby, that a biological child. All they want is a healthy baby. And that's why you will be a mom. There are different ways of becoming a mom, and this is one of the ways, and you'll be a great mom. So go for it if you want to. It should be your decision and your choice.
Oh, that's lovely. And Sophie, anything that you want to say to anyone who might be about to embark on this journey?
I don't think there's anything that I can say that will make it any easier for anybody, because it's hard. It's probably the hardest thing you'll ever do, emotionally, physically, everything. But I think the main thing I would say is just let yourself feel how you need to feel. I am a massive worrier. I've been really anxious throughout this whole time. And for me, I think I've just had to let myself feel all of those things. There's no point in worrying if I worry too much or I'm too stressed, is this not going to happen? Because if that was the case, I absolutely would not be pregnant, because I could not be more of a stress head if I tried. So I think that's like one way that you can take some pressure off yourself. And also, if you feel comfortable, talk to people about how you're feeling, not even necessarily people that you know. If you don't feel comfortable opening up, there's so many kind of avenues of support out there. And I've found like reaching out to other people that have been through something similar, so, so helpful. As much as people that you know, and, you know, family and friends want to help you, and in some ways they can, they can't understand everything that you're thinking and going through, no matter how hard they try. And I would definitely say, if you can and you feel comfortable, reach out and speak to people, because to me, that's just been so, so helpful. So yeah, just keep talking and feel how you feel, and don't feel bad about it.
That's amazing advice. Thank you both so, so much. I found that fascinating. Also, yeah, just, gosh, really emotional, and just so lovely that there are women like you out there helping other families have families. And Sophie, I really appreciate your absolute honesty about your journey. So both of you are amazing. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for covering it and raising awareness as well.
Firstly, I want to say a huge thank you to my guests today for being so open and honest about personal topics on such a public platform. That takes real bravery and will help so many others. I genuinely believe that one person's honesty can help free many. If you found today's episode helpful, please do head to the show notes to find links and support our guests feel may be useful. Secondly, this podcast can only help those who know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate us with a 5-star rating and leave us a review, or hit follow to be the first to hear when our next episode lands. While podcasts are easy to listen to, they take a lot of effort to create, and your support in sharing Bun in the Oven will help me encourage more guests to join me for future episodes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and enjoy the rest of your day.